succession number 28353, reel 13.
Well, thank you, Speeder, for that. If you'd like to continue.
Yeah, I mean, we've been covering the sort of the pressure for the services to move on diversity and the pressure on them to move in the area of equal opportunities. The third area, where, again, a lot of time, effort, consideration, was on the issue of homosexuality in the armed forces. When I went into this job initially, we had just done a study on homosexuality, and the advice which had been accepted by ministers was that this would not be accepted in the services, that the difficulties that it would produce, the anger that would and resentment that it would cause outweighed any benefits of allowing homosexuals to join the service. And that had been accepted, was a recommendation of chiefs and had been accepted by ministers. That was where we were when I came into this job. But clearly still a great deal of unconvinced people, ministers, and indeed some perhaps, I think the CDS of the day, subsequent CDS, Guthrie, I think did not agree with the line that had been taken by the services and agreed by ministers, and therefore we had to go round the boy, as it were, once again on homosexuality during my 3 years. And we did, and we came to the conclusion that we should open the three services to homosexuality under a particular code of conduct. And again, I think this was an area in which the services had got it wrong. I think our experience since the opening up has shown that it wasn't the issue that we thought it was going to be. There hasn't been the resentment. The people who have joined, or those that were already in the service and were homosexuals, they have just gone on, and it hasn't been a major issue. There's been very little advertising of the fact. We haven't had a whole number of homosexuals who have either joined us since or were in the service already coming out and saying, "I'm a homosexual," and making a great song and dance about it. I think it just quietly goes on, and it doesn't cause a great problem. I mean, I'm sure there will be and have been the odd instance where it's been detrimental to operational effectiveness, and that will have been dealt with, but it has not been the problem that the single services thought that it was going to be.
But doesn't it place your four-man squad under any pressure then?
Well, you could come back and say, if you know, if you've got a homosexual in that four-man team, you may get a relationship. Yes, that's true. And if that was shown to be the case, then you would have to deal with it. And, of course, under the code of conduct, we could deal with it.
But it would, by nature, be more covert than a heterosexual relationship.
It might be, but then because it was more covert and the other team members weren't aware of it, then it wouldn't break down the trust.
Ah, but they would know, wouldn't they? I've never been a member of a four-man squad, but no. I thought it's...
But if therefore it wasn't... If it was obvious, then you could deal with it. If it wasn't obvious, it wouldn't break down the trust. Whereas I think with a mixed gender, it is almost impossible for there not to be some sort of relationship. Even if it's only one of deference. In other words, you know, can I help you? You know, not actually pursuing the objective because the girl has been injured, the team ceasing to move forward rather than leaving her there and getting on with it, actually caring for her. So that sort of relationship, which is not what you need in combat. So yes, I could see how a homosexual relationship could break down the trust, but then we could deal with it, because that, if it breaks down operational effectiveness, then we've got grounds for moving in and disrupting the team. If you've got heterosexuals, then you can't outlaw a relationship because it's perfectly normal and respectable. So a lot of work on that side, and as I say, I think we've got personally got the right answer, and that the worries and concerns that the services had prior to it were unfounded.
And General Guthrie was more advanced, if I can put it that way, in a neutral sense than some of his other colleagues.
I think
colleagues.
He felt that we had got the decision wrong by rejecting it when it was reviewed in sort of 94-ish time, and therefore I think he was much happier with the outcome as it eventually materialised, that we would accept homosexuals, we would not administratively discharge them and so forth, unless they broke the code of conduct which was drawn up.
Right.
We've spoken already about medical and the outcome of Defence Cost Study 19, which, as I say, really broke up the medical services as single service organisations. They became much more centralised under the Surgeon General. The Surgeon General himself now answered to the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff for personnel and programmes. All secondary care was now under the Surgeon General, so the single services lost control of the secondary care, in other words, the hospital type services. The training was done under a centralised basis, and the setting up of these MOD hospital units. And huge problems of retention. I mean, the single services lost many of their key specialists, general surgeons, orthopaedic surgeons, anaesthetists, got down to single figure numbers when we ought to have had many more. At a time when the need to support operations was going up, and therefore the need to deploy field hospitals and field ambulances never been greater, but not enough people to man them without calling out the territorial army and the reservists, who were not particularly keen necessarily to be called out too often. So great pressure on the few remaining specialists that you had, who then found more and more of their time being deployed without necessarily a great deal to do, because not huge numbers of casualties in theatre, but you had to have the capability just in case. So they'd go for 6 weeks as a surgeon, not do anything as a surgeon, come back to their peacetime job, find that they'd lost the whole of their patient base because patients had got fed up because they were away and they'd gone to somebody else. He then spent 6 months trying to re-establish a patient base, only to be then deployed again at the end of 6 months. So again, lots of frustration, lots of pressure on these few remaining specialists who, for many, this was the end of the straw. So trying to rebuild the medical services, a real problem, and I'm not sure that we have still got it right. Obviously, a lot has moved on since then. We have managed to set up this Centre of Defence Medicine, a Centre of Excellence in Birmingham, which has at least given the single services a feel that they were important, and therefore they might want to be recruited and retained. We've slowly built the number of specialists up. I think we have strengthened the command and control of the medics. We've released the Surgeon General from outside of the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff for Personnel, so he runs his own sort of organisation. We've got his own 3-star Deputy Chief of Defence Staff for the medical services now. And so there is greater confidence, but it's taken a long time, and we're still not. I think we ought to have, and what ought to have happened was that each of the single services ought to have kept one hospital each, and we should have had one hospital for each service and perhaps one of these MOD medical units linked to Peterborough, Frimley Park and Derriford, and I think that might have worked, providing the single service hospitals had, if they hadn't got enough service patients, had been totally opened up to the NHS as well. So any spare capacity had been utilised. I think that would have been the compromise which would have kept the morale within the single service specialists. But it was totally destroyed by DCS-19. Another thing which was taking up a lot of time was NAFI. NAFI had gone or was going through a particularly bad time that stage. I, in my job as DCS-PMP, was president of the NAFI Institute. We were losing money. The structure had become particularly flabby. We had had a man from Marks and Spencer's seconded to us, a chap called Geoffrey Dart, to look at the running of NAFI. He had produced a report which came in to me. It was a good report, and we managed to persuade him to stay on as the chief operating officer, if you like, of NAFI. So he continued his secondment from Marks and Spencer's and spent 2 or 3 years as the chief executive of NAFI, and he turned it round from being a loss-making organisation into a profit-making organisation. And so we turned that round, but it again obviously took quite a lot of oversight.
Now, if you make a profit, do the Treasury immediately say to the RAF or to the services as a whole, oh, well, you only need this amount of money less the amount of profit you've made, or do you generate a little bit of surplus which goes into the services?
Yeah, no, the profit that NAFI made was largely turned back into the services as sort of welfare provision. Now, if that had not been there, then the government probably would have had to make alternative monies available. So it wasn't necessarily a free goof, but it was ploughed back into the services and, of course, some of the profit back into modernising NAFI facilities. So where their facilities were run down, then the profit they made was also put back into that, which was to the benefit of the services. But equally, some of the profit was just sheer ploughed back as cash into the to do what they wanted on the welfare side, which was a useful source of money, which all but had dried up sort of when it was going through its really bad time. Now, subsequently to that, they've had to restructure again, because having gone from loss to profit, they went back into loss again, and so they have shed off a lot of the peacetime structure, the sort of the NAFI shops and things of that nature on our stations, and that has been privatised, and NAFI now really only look after the support required for deployed forces. But as a result, they've actually gone back into profit again. So it's had a sort of a sinusoidal experience. I mentioned before staff training. One of the things that I had to do was to find a way forward on a centralised staff college for all three services, against the backdrop that Greenwich, Camberley and Bracknell were to go. Great deal of infighting between the services, all three of them wanting to be the college which would run on, and originally Bracknell was decided it would run on, but rightly that was closed as well, and we've now gone for Shrivenham, but that took quite a lot of work trying to get the services to say, getting somebody in to run the appropriates and so forth, but the right decision taken at the end of the process. Helicopter training, centralised all of that under, again, a tri-service organisation at Shawbury. For some reason, the DCS-PMP put in charge of getting us from a notion that we should do it on a tri-service basis to getting it up and running within the Defence Helicopter Flying Training School at Shawbury. Having got it up and running, then delegating sort of operational control to the Royal Air Force to oversee it once it was set up.
Was there resistance from the Navy on that?
resistance from both the other two services. Yeah. And, you know, I suspect if it had gone to the Navy, then the Air Force would have been upset as well. So these were the sort of the early days of jointry, which became a very fashionable aspect, particularly later during the Strategic Defence Review. These were the sort of the early stages of that, although there had been huge pressure to centralise the staff function in MOD, the policy-making function. We were now starting to see various strands of combining the actual delivery of capability. So medical, staff training, here we've got defence helicopter training being done on a joint basis. So these were the early strands of a much greater approach called jointry, which came particularly to the fore during the defence cost study, which we'll come to, not to mention the strategic defence review, which we'll come to later. Sale of the Married Quarter estate. Conservative idea to produce a huge one-time lump sum of money. So the sale of the Married Quarters to Addington Homes for £1.6 billion, of which the MOD got a measly £100 million back. And I think this was not a good policy decision, but driven very largely by the Permanent Undersecretary of the day and ministers, but something which again came under my auspices to try and get the best deal that we could. And I think we got quite a reasonable sum of money as a whole for it, but defence got absolutely nothing. Got, you know, £100 million out of £1.6 billion. So it was just a good deal for the Treasury, and we were lumbered not only with an organisation which probably wasn't going to look after our state terribly well, but all sorts of uncertainties, because built into the contract was a rent review strand over which you virtually had no control. And so anybody who knows anything about property knows that rents are going to almost certainly go up significantly over time, and whereas you started from a baseline with Addington Homes and an agreed rental stream, and that was all sort of in balance, and although we had the ability to shed, if we wanted, Married Quarters to Addington Homes, in 5 years' time, the rental stream was probably going to be very, very different to the rental stream that you first started with. And where was that money going to come from? If it went up, as it certainly did, it had to come from the defence vote, because the people who paid rent for the Married Quarters, that was completely delinked, and rightly so, from the actual market value rental stream that MOD was paying on the property. And so 5 years later, the cost to Addington Homes had gone up enormously, and we now find it very, very difficult to service that particular stream of money. So it was not a good move from the defence perspective. Frankly, it didn't, I don't think, disadvantage too badly the occupant of the Married Quarter, because he really saw nothing of the Addington Homes. What he saw was the centralisation of looking after his quarter into the sort of the MOD-run property management side, but he didn't see the effect of selling off his Married Quarter, because he didn't pay rent to Addington Homes. Mr. Addington never came round and saw him. If he wanted anything done to his quarter, because the window was broken or there was a leak in the roof, he went to the Defence Housing Executive, which was again a centrally run organisation under the DCSP&P, who provided a tri-service response to looking after quarters. And I don't, though there were some areas where there was difficulties, and of course the single services always felt that they could do it better than the Defence Housing Executive. I think in many ways the Defence Housing Executive was actually a step in the right direction.
What is the rent today that roughly is being paid?
Well, it varies. I don't think I could quote you. I mean, I know what my rent was when I last left, and it was something like £5,000 or £6,000 a year for the house that I was living in. Less than the market rent would be, but still a reasonable sum of money.
Yes.
So yes, about £500 a month.
Now, what my question was, I was just wondering, the government gets £1.6 billion in 1990.
Well, this would have been 96, 97.
And I'm just wondering whether Addington Homes have already received, in under 10 years, £1.6 billion in rent.
Oh, I'm sure they have.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sure they, and Jimmy McPherson or whatever, is laughing all the way to the bank.
This is what I thought.
Bank. Yes.
This is what I thought.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I think it was, we probably didn't get enough out of Addington's in the first place, although £1.6 billion was quite a lot of money. We certainly didn't get enough when you now look at the rental stream that the MOD are having to pay, but equally, MOD didn't get a large enough share of the £1.6 billion either.
No. But it's yet another instance of, whether MOD get it or not, of a government asset being privatised,
yes,
effectively.
Yes, under a Conservative-led government whose major drive was to privatise and contractorise and...
Yes, but my point is, privatised, not for value.
Yes, yes.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
The other sort of streams of activity, clearly I was heavily involved in providing advice to the Armed Forces Pay Review Body, which is the independent organisation which looks after remuneration and charges for the armed forces below the rank of Air Commodore, Brigadier and Commodore. And also providing advice to the Senior Salaries Review Body, which provides the remuneration advice to the government on two-star rank and above, and senior civil servants, and so forth. And I obviously, sort of, if you like, provided the highest level interface with those two particular bodies. When I first got into post, something called the Bett Report had just been done by Sir Michael Bett, who had been in BT, been a chairman of BT. He came and did a report on the personnel aspects of the three services, produced quite a long, detailed report, which, for example, argued that the three services had far too many ranks and that whole great swathe. In other words, the structure of the armed forces didn't match the structure of a modernised BT, where a lot of delayering had gone on. We had too many layers, so we could get rid of this rank, that rank, and so forth. And as a result of his report, of course, the five-star rank went. And I won't say that's a bad thing, but certainly his arguments for taking out a lot of the other ranks at a lower level were flawed, and indeed the services didn't take all his recommendations. He also, one thing I think he was right on, was that at the time of his report, the chiefs of staff seemed to take very little interest in the overall policy-making aspects of personnel. It was left very much to the single service personnel gurus, Second Sea Lord, Adjutant General, and CNC Personnel and Training Command, and the DCDS personnel at the time. And Bett's recommendation, the Chiefs of Staff did pay more attention to this, and so we set up a personnel part of the Finance and General Purposes, FPMG, Finance and Policy Making Group, which was chaired by PUS for normal purposes, but then chaired by the CDS when it was looking at service personnel issues, and that probably was a good recommendation out of the BET report, because I think probably chiefs weren't looking sufficiently at the personnel function.
Just before we proceed then, the five-star rank went at this time.
Yes.
And I think you said that you did not view that unfavourably.
Well, I think it wasn't easy to argue against it, I think, because, you know, if you've got a minister who's saying, well, look, the American armed forces, which are, you know, four times larger than we are, they don't have a five-star rank, so how can you justify it? And therefore it wasn't easy. But I think in retrospect it was wrong from the point of view, I think my own view is that the Chief of Defence Staff should be a five-star rank, because I think, you know, it's all very well. I think there are good grounds for the CDS being a rank above his single service chiefs of staff, but apart from lamenting to a degree the departure, I don't think it's easy to justify what had gone on, whereby, for example, the single service chiefs were promoted to five star in their last day in post, so that they retired as five star officers, whereas they hadn't been five star officers in post. To an extent, it's a personal shame, because it would have been jolly nice to have had that privilege, but I don't think it was easy to justify it. I mean, I think in this day and age it looks slightly odd. Quite why it was done, I'm not entirely sure.
I know nothing about the talk. I completely disagree. I think that if someone spends 30 or more years, active years, in a service which, compared to their contemporaries in the city or industry or in any of those fields, you are financially less well off. One of the advantages must be a form of honour, if you like, to say you have reached the top of your service, and or you may even have been CDS, and the nation recognises this.
Yes, and that's why I say I think for the CDS, in post, he ought to be a five-star officer in post.
But it also applies to the chiefs when they retire.
But if you say that they need that recognition, and you're right, I mean, single services chiefs are not well paid in comparison to their counterparts in industry and banking and so forth, not at all well paid for having huge responsibility. You're absolutely right. But if that's the case, then it ought to be recognised whilst they're serving, not just recognised the moment they retire. You're right. I mean, they retire with a pension which is equivalent to half their pay, but then so does everybody else, and that's not a huge sum of money. But it ought to be corrected whilst you're serving, not just on retirement, and not just on retirement for those three or four individuals, it seems to me, because the person who doesn't quite get to being the chief of his own service, he retires having had huge responsibility, but on a relatively modest pension.
But that applies to the people who didn't quite manage to be chairman of ICI, of which they're always.
Well, yes, but his deputy is on a financial package which is far superior to the financial package of the deputy to the chief of air staff.
I see the point, yes.
Far more advantageous. Now, you could say, well, deputy to the chief of air staff can go and work for BAES or something of that nature when he retires. Well, yes, I suppose he can. You might not have the ability to do that as a retired chief because of representational responsibilities.
Perhaps one should improve the pension provision for senior officers, for very senior officers.
Hmm. I think my own view is that it ought be their salaries too ought to be looked at, which it is, and gradually I think salaries are being uplifted through an element of performance-related pay, which I don't actually particularly agree with.
Performance-related pay in the armed forces?
Yes.
How do you achieve that? Yes. As you don't have an earnings per share.
No. In the Armed Forces Pay Review Body group, you now have, as well as a cost of living increase, you have an increment as well. So each year your pay goes up by a cost of living award recommended by the Armed Forces Pay Review Body and an increment related to performance. However, everybody gets that increment unless their performance has not been satisfactory. So if a person's performance is assessed as less than satisfactory, then they don't get the increment. They get the cost of living increase, which might be 2%, but they don't get the increment, which might be another 2%. Alright. In the senior salaries review body for 2-star and above, then they too get an increment and may, if they have performed extraordinarily well, get a double increment, but there are very few of those, and that over time is gradually pushing the pay up, because without it the military were falling, starting to fall well behind the civil service opposite.